Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today begins a series on the cosmological argument for God. We'll begin with part one. For many more resources, go to reasonablefaith.org.
Today, then, we want to go to a second argument, which is called the cosmological argument for God's existence. And let me set the framework for this before we jump into it. We had been studying the attributes of God for several months. We brought that section of Christian doctrine to a close, and now we're taking a sort of apologetical excursus to ask, well, are there any good reasons to think that there is such a being as God? And so last week we looked at the first of these arguments. I'm going to share five. That was the argument from contingency, and today we're going to talk about the cosmological argument. Now, the cosmological argument is actually a family of arguments that attempts to show that there is a first cause or sufficient reason for the existence of the cosmos. And there are many different versions of this cosmological argument. As I say, it's really a family of arguments, but they all aim to get back to a kind of first cause or sufficient reason of the existence of the universe. And the version that we're going to look at is a version that was originated by Christian philosophers in the 3rd and 4th century after Christ in response to the Greek doctrine of the eternity of the world. And it's an argument that attempts to prove that the universe had a beginning and therefore requires a transcendent cause to bring it into being. Now, when Islam took over these Middle Eastern lands, like Egypt, Islam absorbed this argument. And this argument was highly developed then by medieval Islamic thinkers, who are well worth still reading today. And that work was then passed back again into the Christian West later in the 12th century and the 13th century. Because of its Arabic or Islamic roots, I have called this version the Kalam cosmological argument. Kalam is the Arabic word for speech. And in medieval Islamic theology, a Kalam came to identify a doctrine or a doctrinal statement, a position. And it was through this movement of Kalam, which was this medieval, scholastic, Islamic theology, that this argument became highly developed and sophisticated. And so to distinguish this version of the cosmological argument from other versions, I've dubbed it the Kalam cosmological argument. So that's the background of this version of the argument. Now, the argument is actually very, very simple in its structure. It consists of two premises and a conclusion. And you see the premises on the outline. Premise one, whatever begins to exist has a cause. Premise two, the universe began to exist, and from that it follows three on the next page, therefore the universe has a cause. And that, in a nutshell, is the argument. It's very, very simple, easy to memorize. And then what we do after this is to explore what does it mean to be a cause of the universe. And you're able to deduce a number of the attributes of this first cause that make it plausibly identifiable as God. So that's the fundamental argument. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. So let's look at each of the premises together. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. It seems to me that this premise is supportable both philosophically and scientifically. Philosophically, I think that this statement is a sort of first principle of metaphysics. For anybody who really contemplates it, I think that it's obvious that whatever begins to exist has a cause. Basically, this is saying that things don't come into being out of nothing. Things don't just pop into existence uncaused out of non-being. Being does not arise from non-being. Being only comes from being. And so, as I say, this is a kind of first principle of metaphysics. And metaphysics, for those who don't know, is that branch of philosophy which deals with the ultimate questions of what is real, what exists. Metaphysics asks about the nature of ultimate reality. Aristotle described metaphysics as the study of being. And so that's why I say this is a sort of first principle of metaphysics, because basically what it says is that being only comes from being. Being does not arise from non-being. Something cannot come into existence out of nothing. Now, as such, I think that the principle is obvious to anybody who understands it, and that any defense you could give of the principle would be based upon premises which are less obvious than the principle itself. And as Aristotle said, you shouldn't try to prove the obvious via the less obvious. So that in that sense, I think it's somewhat maladroit. It's somewhat misconceived to try to argue for the truth of this first premise. It's better to just help the unbeliever understand it and then hope that he's honest enough to grasp it. And there are ways in which you can make this intuitively obvious. For example, one of the things I like to say is that none of us believes that, say, a raging Bengal tiger could suddenly pop into being out of nothing in this room right now. Or that an Eskimo village or a gasoline station might just pop into being uncaused out of nothing in this room. I think anybody recognizes things don't just pop into being uncaused out of nothingness. Sometimes I'll say to audiences, nobody here in the audience is worried that while we're here listening to this talk, that back home in your living room, a horse might have popped into being out of nothing and is there defiling the carpet while we talk. We don't worry about those kind of things. So these aren't arguments, I think you'll understand. These aren't arguments for premise one, but they're just ways of illustrating it, just making it intuitively appealing so that the unbeliever says, yeah, that's obvious. Now, Cindy, I think, had a point.
I just wanted to ask your thought on the unbeliever who says that at the beginning of the universe, prior Big Bang, do they acknowledge that there was a cause? Or they acknowledge there was a cause, they just don't know what the cause is, and they get into the expanding, shrinking universe. And that short.
Now, you're talking about the Big Bang Theory.
Well, I am as an example, but I think it's relevant in that when you talk about a cosmological argument,
yes,
then you have to go back to the very beginning of the
cosmos, right,
to say, how did it come into being? And
right.
I'm curious, when you argue atheists about this very point, do they embrace that, yes, everything that began to exist has a cause, or do they try to argue
okay.
that? Or do they say, yes, it has a cause, we just don't know what it is?
All right.
Okay,
good question. Notice on the outline under 2.3 and 2.31, we will talk in more detail about the scientific aspects of this question. But let me answer Cindy's question directly. When I began to work on this argument in my doctoral work in England, I didn't think anybody would attack the first premise. I thought it would be the second premise they would go after, and therefore that's where I really focused my big guns, was defending the second premise. I have been astonished, Cindy, the degree to which atheists, when their backs are against the wall, will say, the universe just popped into being uncaused out of nothing. Yeah.
They will finally just say, well, it just started.
Yeah. And I have a friend, Quentin Smith, who is a professor of philosophy at the University of Western Michigan. And in our book that we wrote together on theism, atheism, and Big Bang cosmology, his final position is this. He says, the most rational thing to believe is that the universe came from nothing, by nothing, and for nothing. You know, that's sort of a good conclusion to a Gettysburg Address of atheism, I think. But to me, that is the most irrational thing to believe. I think if you can get the atheist to that point, then you have succeeded in your argument. Because it is only, I think, the darkened intellect that can stand before God on the judgment day and say, well, God, the reason I didn't believe in you was because I thought that things could just pop into being uncaused out of nothing, you know. As I sometimes point out in talks, this is really worse than magic. When you think about it, it's worse than magic. Because in magic, when the magician pulls a rabbit out of the hat, you've at least got the hat, and you've got the magician. Yeah. But, you know, in this case, the universe just pops into being out of nothingness.
Yet they will also tell there's no such thing as supernatural or miracles or anything like that. And yet, to me, this is the ultimate miracle.
It is the ultimate miracle. This is an interesting point. We sometimes have talked, I think, in this class about the argument for the resurrection of Jesus, which is a sort of argument for God from miracles. But really, this is the argument from miracles writ large. It is the universe coming into being that requires a supernatural cause beyond the natural realm, because in this case, it is the whole natural realm that comes into being. So it cannot have a natural explanation, because it is the whole theater of natural causes which pops into existence, and so points to a miraculous supernatural explanation. Well, if you're committed to the impossibility of miracles, you can't accept that. But then that gets into the question of miracles, which I'm not talking about now, but notice that only an atheist, only someone who has a proof of atheism, can deny the possibility of miracles. Because as long as God's existence is even possible, then it's possible that there are miracles. So the atheist, in order to avoid this argument, needs to have some sort of a proof that there is no God, and that therefore miracles are impossible. In the absence of a proof of God's non-existence, he needs to be open to the possibility of miracles, and therefore to the possibility that the universe has a cause of its being. Now, as I say, yes, David, go ahead.
Do you ever get objections from physicists about this first point? Because, for example, we know that electrons and positrons sometimes just wink into existence for apparently no reason, and then usually they find each other and they collide and disappear again.
Yes, this is a common objection, and I'm going to treat it in a second when I look at objections to the first premise. But for right now, we're talking about what positive reason is there to adopt it. And I was saying it's intuitively obvious in itself, and it seems to me that we can give illustrations to try to make this evident to the unbeliever that ought to cause him to believe. But in fact, I think there are even philosophical arguments for this. For example, I think it was Jonathan Edwards who argued for this first premise by saying that if things could really pop into being uncaused out of nothing, then it's inexplicable why just anything and everything doesn't pop into being out of nothing. Because after all, before they exist, there isn't any sort of nature that would constrain what sort of things could pop into being out of nothing, because before they exist, there just isn't anything there. So why don't television sets and Charles Darwin and things like this pop into being uncaused out of nothing? If things could really come into being uncaused out of nothing, then it does seem inexplicable why just anything and everything wouldn't do so, which obviously contradicts experience. Yes, Stephanie.
I just wonder if you could get them to at least concede that if God and a supernatural cause doesn't exist, therefore miracles can't exist, to get them to concede that the very possibility of things just popping into being would be miraculous. So in a sense, they're believing in a miracle.
Yeah, that's the difficulty, is that these folks, when their backs are to the wall, will say that it's not miraculous for things to pop into existence uncaused out of nothing. It just happens. You know, remember I said, well, some those of you who were here last week and saw the video, remember what I said about how every person has inside of himself a sort of skeptical dial, and you can ratchet it way up when it comes to arguments for conclusions that you don't like. But then you can dial it way down for your own views. And I think this is the perfect example of this, is that when their backs are to the wall, atheists just dial up that skeptical dial really high and say, you can't prove that whatever comes into being has a cause, that it could just come into being out of nothing. But they would never accept that sort of explanation at any other level of human experience. If you walked into your bedroom and found a horse there, you wouldn't think it just popped into being out of nothing. You would say there had to be a cause for what brought it there. So this is part of this difference that I described last week between what J.I. Packer calls travelers along life's way and balconeers who can discuss the journey, talk about it, but aren't really on the road themselves. Jay?
Well, I was just going to say, I was arguing this with a professor of philosophy down at Georgia State, and it does seem stupid when we talk about it, but he hung his argument largely on Occam's razor and the idea of multiplying entities. He kept saying, we have an entity, that the multiplying entity is more irrational.
Yeah.
To fall back on the argument that this entity exists outside of this.
And yeah.
That's largely where he hung on it.
So. You know, Jay, I heard a lot of atheists appeal to this as a way of avoiding God. Occam's razor is a principle that was enunciated by the medieval Christian philosopher William of Ockham. And basically what it says this is, don't multiply causes beyond necessity. Don't multiply causes beyond necessity. So this is a great principle to use, say, in arguing for monotheism rather than polytheism. It's unnecessary to posit many gods as the cause of the universe. One God will do it. So Occam's razor would say, on the basis of this argument, whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, you're rational to infer that there is a cause of the universe. But you wouldn't be justified in inferring, say, that there were three causes of the universe, so that there was a panoply of gods or something like that. But Occam's razor, properly used, doesn't in any way say that you shouldn't make causal inferences, because it states, don't multiply causes beyond necessity. But if it's necessary to have some cause, well, then of course you posit some explanation. This is the way science works. For example, we find fossil bones in the earth. Now, you could say, don't think, you know, on Occam's razor, you mustn't think that there were once living animals that left these remains. That would be multiplying causes. So we just stick with the bones, you know. They're just bones in the earth. That's it. There never were any dinosaurs. Well, that would be absurd, of course. The scientist posits these theoretical entities called dinosaurs as the best explanation for why we find these fossilized bones in the earth. And to refuse to posit a cause for these is really to refuse to do science. It's to refuse to seek causal explanations. So the proper use of Occam's razor is, you just don't multiply causes beyond what is necessary to explain the effect. You're only justified in positing such causes as are necessary to explain the effect. But it would be silly, and I mean, it's hard for me to understand how a professor can say this. It would be silly to say you just stay with the effect and you never ask for the cause.
He was under the, and he defined Occam. He stressed entity over cause. He kept saying that the proper use of Occam's razor in his definition of it was multiplying entities, not causes. And so he said that it was always more rational to multiply entities than to accept the causal principle of the universe, which.
Well, that doesn't seem to make sense to me, because a cause is an entity. I mean, you're positing here what in science would be called a theoretical entity to explain some effect. For example, you see a trace in a cloud chamber, so you postulate a theoretical entity called an electron to explain that. Or in quantum physics, entities like quarks are postulated as the best explanation for certain effects that we observe. And they're entities. I mean, causes are entities. So that seems to me to be a distinction without a difference. So don't be fooled by this Occam's razor thing. This is a misuse of Occam's razor to try to subvert or avoid causal inferences. Because even more, sometimes this is called simplicity. People will say you go for the simpler explanation. And certainly simplicity is a virtue of explanations. A simpler theory is a better explanation than a unnecessarily complex theory. But in addition to simplicity, there are lots of other explanatory virtues too. For example, explanatory power would be one of the most important. That is to say, the explanation, first and foremost, has to have the power to explain the effect. It does no good to have a simple theory if it has no explanatory power. I mean, that would be worthless as a theory to say, oh, but this theory is so simple, but it explains nothing. You know, so you know, simplicity can be sacrificed if there's a substantial gain in explanatory power. Another theoretical virtue would be explanatory scope. That is to say, does the explanation just explain a narrow range of data, or does this entity explain a broad range of data? And if you have an explanation that has a broader explanatory scope, as well as good explanatory power, that also might be a reason to offset adopting a more complex theory. So you could sacrifice simplicity for a gain in explanatory scope. Now, one of the interesting things about these arguments for God's existence that I'm sharing is that not just each one has explanatory power, but together they show that the hypothesis of God's existence has tremendous explanatory scope. It explains things like why anything exists rather than nothing, why the universe came into being 13.5 billion years ago, why there is an objective realm of moral values in the world. It explains things like the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. It explains the incredible fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life. So that there's this broad range of the data of human experience that is all explained by postulating the existence of God. So this is a view that has tremendous explanatory scope as well as explanatory power, and it doesn't really violate Occam's razor at all, because Occam's razor simply says, don't multiply causes beyond what is necessary to explain the effect. Scotty?
I see why he used Occam's razor to counter what he was saying. He's saying that we have principles of mathematics, of physics, of chemistry, etc. If you do this and you do that, the result is this. Always. It always works that way. That's pretty much true in everything in the sciences that we encounter. If you extrapolate backward, there's no reason to come up with a supernatural existence for the universe, because we have all these properties that work. We know they work. The formation of the universe is simply these properties put into motion at a time that we don't understand.
Well, the difficulty...
Hey, we know these things work. Now you want to say that beyond the ability of all of this knowledge we have to explain why things are what they are, you want to bring in a supernatural being to set them in motion. I can see why the guy presented that
argument. This argument says that you need a being beyond the natural realm, because that natural realm that you've described, governed by the laws of physics, which can be given mathematical expression, that realm itself came into existence a finite time ago. And things don't just come into existence out of nothing. Now, the natural laws themselves cannot explain why the universe came into existence, because it is the realm, that natural realm governed by those laws, that itself has come into existence. So you've got to have something that's outside the realm to explain why this realm governed by these natural laws came into being. Yes, Stephanie again.
Well, I was just wondering, he mentioned the mathematics and the physics, and I'm thinking, if you're going to use Occam's razor to refute the idea, I've lost what I thought. If you're going to use that to refute the idea of one supernatural cause, and you even go mathematically, I can't shake the feeling that if you use Occam's razor, that if you multiply causes beyond what is necessary, if there's zero cause, mathematically, there's no multiplication. You come out with zero. The most simplest mathematical answer is that there's one cause.
Yeah. All right. It's important to see that this principle is not itself a mathematical principle. This is not a natural law. It's not a mathematical principle. This is more a sort of, it's a metaphysical principle, or it's a methodological principle for deciding which theory to adopt. It isn't itself part of science. It's more one of those philosophical assumptions that underlie science. So, say you have this natural realm like this, a space and time, And it's governed by all these equations, you know, like E equals MC squared and things like that, all these equations that operate in this realm. But this realm itself came into being. Then the question is, you know, why did this realm come into existence? If you deny that there is a transcendent cause, then you've got to say it just popped into being and caused out of nothing, which seems to me, as I say, to be metaphysically absurd and violates his first principle. Now, let me say something else about this. I've been talking about philosophical reasons to adopt this first premise, that it seems metaphysically obvious once you understand it, and that we can give an argument based upon that if it were false, everything and anything ought to come into being uncaused. But moreover, I think that it also is confirmed constantly in our experience. In our experience, we have good empirical evidence for thinking this premise is true. It's constantly verified. It's never falsified. And so, of all of the facts of experience, this first premise ought to stand right at the top of the heap in terms of empirical confirmation. So, whether you look at philosophical evidence or scientific empirical evidence, it seems to me we have good grounds for believing premise one. At least, at the very least, we have better grounds for believing it than its negation. And remember, last week, that's what I said is necessary for the argument to be a good argument. Doesn't have to be 100% certain, but as long as you're 51% certain that one is true rather than it's contradictory, this is a good argument. So it does seem to me that based on philosophical reasoning and scientific evidence, that this first premise is more plausible than it's contradictory. Now, let me deal with objections that might be raised against this premise, and here I want to get to David's point, that it is very, very often said that subatomic physics or quantum physics is a counterexample to this first principle. That the physics of the subatomic realm, quantum physics, shows an exception to this first principle. Because on the subatomic realm, certain types of particles, like virtual particles, can come into being for a fleeting moment out of the quantum vacuum, which is this sort of sea of energy that underlies all of reality. And spontaneously, these particles can come into being, and then they almost immediately vanish back into the vacuum again. And sometimes people have tried to apply quantum physics to the origin of the universe and say, well, maybe the universe is just a fluctuation out of nothingness. And sometimes you'll hear these almost rhetorical expressions like, nothingness is unstable, or the universe is a free lunch because we got something for nothing, or the universe is a quantum fluctuation out of nothingness, and so forth. But I think that this objection is based on misunderstandings. In the first place, and this is the number one point, not all physicists agree that the quantum realm is causally indeterminate. That is to say, not all quantum physicists believe that the quantum realm, the subatomic realm, is not causally determined. The indeterministic interpretation of quantum physics is under the so-called Copenhagen interpretation, which is the interpretation of the father of quantum mechanics, Niels Bohr, Danish physicist. And on the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics, it's true that these particles are said to arise spontaneously out of the vacuum without any sufficient determining cause. However, you need to understand, and most people don't understand, that the Copenhagen interpretation is just one of many different interpretations of quantum physics. In other words, any scientific theory has a mathematical core, and then it has a physical interpretation of the mathematics. And quantum mechanics has the same mathematical core, but it has at least 10 different physical interpretations that I can think of, at least 10. And not all of these 10 are indeterministic. For example, David Bohm has an interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is fully deterministic. On this view, the uncertainty is purely mental. You may not be able to determine what is the cause of the origin of some quantum event, but it does have a cause. And Bohm's theories are mathematically consistent. They are entirely consistent with the evidence. There's no way evidentially to distinguish between the Copenhagen and the Bohmian interpretation, and yet the Bohmian interpretation is fully deterministic. So when people tell you that quantum mechanics furnishes a counterexample to the premise one, all you have to do is simply point out that that is not a proven counterexample, because there are lots of interpretations of quantum physics that are fully deterministic, and so this is not a proven exception to premise one. But secondly, second point I want to make, even on this Copenhagen interpretation, these particles do not come into being out of nothing. They don't come into being out of nothing. The quantum vacuum is not what the layman thinks of when you say the word vacuum, namely nothing. The quantum vacuum is a sea of fluctuating energy. It is an arena of violent activity, and it is governed by physical laws. So it is far from nothing. And what happens is, on the Copenhagen interpretation, that this energy locked up in the vacuum fluctuates and can spontaneously, for a brief time, spin off particles that then dissolve back into the energy of the vacuum, so that they do not come into being out of nothing, as would be the case with the origin of the universe. Take the question in a second. I want to make a third point, though. The third point is that on interpretations of the origin of the universe, in which the universe comes into being out of the vacuum, the same point holds. Namely, they do not talk about the universe coming into being out of nothing. As we'll see later when we get down to 2.34, the vacuum fluctuation theory, they are talking about a sea of fluctuating energy out of which the universe originates as a vacuum fluctuation. So it is not creation from nothing. So when you read in popular magazine articles and newspapers that the universe is a free lunch because it came out of nothing, or that nothingness is unstable to fluctuations, this is just a misuse of language. These are rhetorical flourishes that are not taken seriously by scientists and philosophers. Nothingness, when you think about it, can't have any properties because it isn't anything. To say that nothingness is unstable or has properties is to treat it as though it were something. And so nothingness can't have any properties because it just isn't anything. So it can't have instability or any things of that sort. So we'll talk more about these models later on, but I think this is enough to say why quantum physics doesn't furnish a counterexample to premise one. Let me just quote from a philosopher of science named Robert Del Tette. This is what he says by way of summary. There is no basis in ordinary quantum theory for the claim that the universe itself is uncaused, much less for the claim that it sprang into being uncaused from literally nothing. All right. Now, was there any comment on that? David, did you want to comment on that? Or
I think your second point, that this quantum vacuum is really not the same as nothing, is an excellent one.
Okay.
It's easy for lay people to get mixed up about that, but you're right on that. I would say your first point about other interpretations, most folks do buy into this Copenhagen interpretation right now.
Uh-huh.
It may change in the future, but that's pretty much what people are thinking.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you that this is the traditional view. But I think that that may just sort of be the contemporary paradigm, but it isn't to say that it's therefore, well, it's certainly not empirically better than Bohm's because they're empirically equivalent. So it's a matter of taste in a sense. All right, any other comment or question on this first premise? Yes?
Is there any
Kathy.
Argument there about the fact that these things that pop out of nothing can't sustain themselves, they disappear, is that...
Well, this is a good point. I mean, in the quantum vacuum, when you have, like, as David said, a positron and an electron coming into being, they can't stay in being longer than something called the Heisenberg indeterminacy principle allows, because then you would violate physics. So they have to dissolve back into the vacuum in a real hurry, or it's going to upset the scientific apple cart. So these particles are sort of able to hide, in a sense, in this period of scientific ignorance. And I think that's why Bohm's view is plausible, to say that this uncertainty is just in our heads. It's not necessarily in reality. Yes?
I have a question, and this is kind of annoying at me. But, like, what caused God? Or is that a good question?
It's a good question, though I'm not sure this is the right point to raise it. That would be better raised later on. Okay. But let me just say this. What you will see, let's see, Dan? What we'll see, Danny, if you look at 4.1 on the second page, the outline, is that this first cause must be uncaused. So that the question then will be that God doesn't have a cause, and we'll...
I've lowered my... What do you call it?
Your skeptical dial.
My skeptical dial, saying, okay, because I'm a Christian. I want a good answer, but I feel this knowing it.
Right. Well, we'll look at that later on when we get to 4.1. Okay, well, I don't want to take us beyond our time, but yes, Mary?
Companies asked me if they could have a copy of the Oscar
Yeah, I have a copy here, and we could have somebody photocopy it off for folks who want it. Okay, I'll give that to Mary. All right, well then, we'll see you next week, and we'll continue on with our outline beginning to look at premise two.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.